And we have with us Paul Carr, who will be talking about creation care, theology, and technology.
Right, creation care, theology, and technology. Well, the evidence of climate change, I mentioned in my abstract that the last year was the warmest year in record, but I think what is more evident affecting us is the large increase in the number of natural disasters shown in the vertical scale over time, and particularly stands out as the extreme increase in temperatures in the red, and then storms and floods. And there's a physical relationship between these two. As our climate warms, there's more energy in the environment. For example, the hurricanes get their kinetic energy of the wind arises from the thermal energy in the oceans, which are increasing dramatically. So we're seeing more intense storms. They get their energy from the increased temperatures. And similarly, we're getting more floods, more flooding, because at higher temperatures, atmosphere holds more water vapor. So when it rains, there's more of it. It's pretty dramatic, some in recent history, but I'd like to just mention that I got involved in this in 1974. And does anyone remember 1974? How many people remember waiting in lines to fill up their gas tank during the oil shortage? How many are there? Any older people here that remember that? Not the younger people, obviously, but you know, young people might like to know that before 1974, gasoline cost only 34 cents a gallon, something like that. And during that coal oil shortage, oil prices jumped up to over a dollar. So that really got my attention back in 1907. That's when I became involved, and I've been increasingly involved since then. An example of flooding, you've probably heard this news, over 100 people drowned and missing from the flash floods near the Christian Camp Mystic in South Texas. The river there rose like 40 feet in only a few hours just due to the intense rainfall. Again, an example of when it rains, there are more of it because of higher temperatures. There's water, more water in the atmosphere. And this struck me personally because I have a daughter and granddaughters. My daughter Sylvia just lives a few hundred miles north of where this Camp Mystic. And so I called her and I said, well, how are you doing? And she lives close to a river too. The river in Mystic was the Guadalupe, and she lives next to the, so how are you doing? She said, well, we just had a few puddles in our garage, so I felt relieved. But here's some more data, though, on flooding. Here's the NOAA data. This is billion-dollar weather disaster. So you have to, I suspect that the economics of that flood in the Camp Mystic probably didn't have a billion-dollar impact in our economy. But you can see that there's flooding. Is the blue here, and flooding has been increasing, as you can see. More recently, there's more flooding that are more billion-dollar floods. Sort of maybe the wonderful past, and the wonderful past, you can see since 1908, the number of extreme billion-dollar weather was stayed below roughly five, and then dramatically and alarmingly since about the year 2000, we've seen the number of dramatic weather events, billion-dollar increase dramatically, and also there's a cost associated with that, and the cost. Let me just go back. Is this right here? Billion-dollar annual cost in the 1980s. You can see that's the solid five-year average cost was about 15 billion, and the average cost is now shown here about 185 billion. So a dramatic increase in the cost. And you know, it's been said that a billion dollars here and a billion dollars there, pretty soon you have real money. Well, the total cost of these disasters is in the trillion-dollar ballpark. So it's becoming a significant impact on our economy. Well, I wrote this book published in January, containing climate change to save us, and I start out by citing Canadian evangelical climate scientist Catherine Hayhoe, now in Texas. In her book Saving Us, says to care about climate change, you need to only care about one thing, and that's a person living on planet Earth who wants a better future. And then theologian Matthew Fox says that what unites us is our common need and Earth's common beneficence. It's time to put out our doctrinal scuffles aside and unite for our good and the future generation's continual good. He, being a theologian, talks about doctrinal scuffles, but I think we're all aware of the political scuffles that are going on today, particularly on the issue of climate change. Well, back in 1979, getting back to my own history, here's a picture of the solar hot water heaters that I placed on the roof of my house in Bedford, New Hampshire. Back in those days, solar photovoltaic panels for electricity were much too costly to be considered. I tell in my book the reason why I needed those hot water heaters. It turns out I had teenage daughters who insisted on shampooing their hair every day before they went to school, and I told them that, you know, oily hair is healthy. You know, your hair might fall out if you don't have a nice oily hair, and you know, who listens to their dad at that stage in their life? So I had not much alternative, as my oil bill was going up dramatically due to the increase in price of gasoline from, say, 30 cents a gallon over a dollar. My energy bills went up dramatically, and so I decided to invest in free solar energy from the sun. Well, it's free, and fast forwarding to last May, just last month, 2 months ago, on May 18th, here's a photograph, a few of the 126 solar panels installed to provide green energy for my 200-year-old Bedford Presbyterian Church, where my wife Ginny and I were married. And this was made possible by modern technology, but I would like to show you the dedication of these panels. You see more of them in the property next to our church. And we show Reverend John Sawyer dedicating, cutting the ribbon with the team leader Brian, our green team leader Brian Martell, who was a major factor in the success of this project, which took over 3 years. And you see other members of the green team. I'm in the far right there. I think this chart explained why solar panels are now viable, and it does illustrate the importance of technological advances in manufacturing technology. As you can see, the solar panel cost has decreased dramatically down here, where it's comparable in cost, slightly lower in cost. So wind and solar are now the cheapest sources of generating electricity, much less than that of natural gas, which has displaced coal because it's also cheaper. Of course, the problem with wind and solar, it's not there all the time. Our church basically uses the grid as a battery. In other words, when we're generating more electricity than we need, we sell energy to the grid, and then on a cloudy day when we need electricity, more electricity than we generate, we buy that electricity back. The trouble with wind and solar, though, as I said, you have to have some other source. It's not a standalone source of activity. And it's the standalone sources that are there all the time are nuclear, which we get 20% of our electricity comes from nuclear. And unfortunately, the cost of nuclear has gone up. At least the new nuclear reactors have been more expensive. However, geothermal looks like their cost of geothermal. Now, are you familiar with geothermal? Basically, the deeper you drill into the earth, the hotter it gets. And if you go down to make like a kilometer or so, which is the typical depth of a fracking well, which has made natural gas so cheap, you get temperatures enough, warm enough for building heating. But if you can go down 10 kilometers, it's hot enough to boil water. And so that steam from that boiling water can be used to turn a turbine that generates electricity. And so geothermal has great potential as we learn to drill deeper. So here's some new technologies that are long term. So I've given you these are technologies that are there all the time, which we need because renewables all by themselves, particularly wind and solar, are intermittent, can't be always be relied on. So my overview from 50 years, starting when I was filling my gas tank back in 1974, had trouble filling my gas tank, is that new technology exemplified by the solar technology, the materials technology, the silicon technology, those advances enabling caring theology is motivating. We motivated us to install these panels. By the way, I might mention that our church, our biggest source need for electricity in our church, about 40% of our electric bill goes to support our food bank, which we house the food bank for people who are food challenged. And you've heard that SNAP, the being cut, the funds being cut, that SNAP is Supplementary Nutrition Assistance Program. We'll obviously be having more people needing food challenge, and we'll be prepared to meet that challenge. It turns out that 41% goes to the refrigerators so that people food challenge can have milk out of the refrigerator, particularly in other cold drinks. So new technology, caring theology, enabling economics, we need that to save our ecology. So my book, Climate Change, Containing Climate Change to Save Us, chapter 16, I note that creation care, theology and technology, basically science whose fossil fuel technology unintentionally caused the climate crisis, must be combined with creation care theology, namely creation spirituality. Science gives us the technical know-how, and creation care theology complements with moral motivation. And I think this is particularly evident in Pope Francis' encyclical, his Laudate Si, on care for our common home, has a title inspired by his namesake, St. Francis of Assisi's famous poem, Brother Sun and Sister Moon. Laudate Si translates into as praise be you, and carries a message in spirit and echoes much of St. Francis's soul. More people are acting on Pope Francis' encyclical on creation, care, spirituality, ethics, and ecology. He addressed it to Christians and not, and believers or not. He urges us all to stop pillaging our planet for profit, the poor suffering the most. He enjoins us to hear the cry of the poor and hear the cry of our earth. Creation spirituality includes social and environmental justice. So here's a photo illustrating Brother Sun. Hard to take a picture of the sun in the daylight, but this is the sun rising on Lake Eden, where I grew up in northern Vermont, on the Maristill waters early morning. And then late at night, there was a moon rise with a moon reflected. Here's Sister Moon illuminating Lake Eden, Vermont. I must say, after I had this beatific vocation in northern Vermont, the week later, as I learned when I got back home, that our state capital in Montpelier, which is next to a river, there was a flash flood that caused the streets of New Hampshire to be flooded, including our state office buildings, several feet of water again from another flash flood that raised the height of the river again. And another example of the atmosphere holding more water at higher temperatures, and then when it does rain, there's more of it. So Laudato Si, and care for our common home. And that encyclical in 2000, 2015, together with Christina Figueres, climate advocacy helped 196 countries commit to reducing their carbon emissions at the UN Council of Parties in 2000 in France. And this helped Roman Catholic President Joe Biden pass the multi-billion dollar 2002 Inflation Reduction and Climate Act, the most significant climate change legislation the U.S. government has passed. And the act included economic incentives for more green technology. So beautifying technology, enabling economics, new green technology are needed to save our ecology. And here's a photo I took of yesterday's session. There, Reverend Dr. Jessica Mirman speaking at our ASA workshop yesterday. It was called Climate Change Mitigation from a Biblical Perspective. And this is a talk she gave us several years ago, noting that climate change has also affects our human health, particularly the aerosols from coal burning are very bad for asthma and for lung cancer and all the other impacts that the impact is as Pope Francis says, the impact of higher energy costs are much more burdensome on poor people than on well-to-do people. So let's support her mission to individuals, churches, and the government. So in chapter 18 of my book, I talk about what we can do now to reverse global warming. And I draw on the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming, first published in 2017. You can Google Project Drawdown, and he ranks 100 ways of reducing global warming. Onshore wind turbines for electricity are number one. Number two, the utility scale photovoltaic panels, like we had in our church, would account for that. Now you notice utility scale panels are more economical and more highly rated than the photovoltaics on people's roofs, mainly because the economy of scale. We were 126. Generally, the number of photovoltaics on a roof are much more limited. What really struck me, though, was that plant-rich diets to stop methane emissions from animals are ranked number three. And this is something we can all do immediately. We can't take a while to put in new photovoltaics. It takes a while to buy an electric vehicle, but we can all do that with our next meal. The reason for that is that the methane, of course, is a greenhouse gas, which is even more potent than increasing carbon dioxide levels from burning fossil fuels. And they come out from both ends of animals, basically from their manure, but also their digestive system. Of course, they can digest. They can just cellulose in grass, which we can't, but in the process, they belch out more emissions. So plant-rich diet. And I've been advocating this to everybody, people in my family, but I had a very honest granddaughter who was wondering if I was practicing what I was preaching. And she's seen me eat chicken occasionally. And my justification for that is that the carbon dioxide emissions from chicken are a lot less than those from beef. Those from beef are much, much greater. And of course, chicken is much better, much lower cholesterol and better for your health. But anyway, that's something we can all do starting with our next meal, a more vegetarian diet, a more plant-rich diet. Electric vehicles, I've been driving a Chevy Bolt since 2017, and they're doubly green. They save your pocketbook. They cut down on your fuel energy costs. You get the equivalent of 100 miles per gallon. And of course, they're saving our planet with no carbon dioxide emissions. And they're fun to drive. I've never had such a peppy car, and I was showing off my new Chevy Bolt and I stepped on it, my wife, to show how peppy it was. And a few days later, it was her turn to drive, and she stepped on it. I couldn't believe it. She's such a safe driver who's always giving me lectures about stopping at stoplights, stop signs, and not using my direction. But there was my wife, Jenny, who had become a hot rod with our new electric car. So they're very peppy. They really are fun to drive. So in addition to saving their planet, at least for me, it's been fun. And similarly, high efficiency heat pumps. By the way, our church is generating and has enough electricity so that we're replacing our fossil burning fuel with heat pumps, which are much more efficient. And then I mentioned the importance of geothermal. So here are ways that we can reverse global warming now. So in conclusion, I'd like to cite climate scientist Catherine Hayo's book, Evangelical Christian, who moved from Canada to Texas in 2005, and her book, Saving Us, Her Hope and Healing in a Divided World. And she's, what can we do? Here's a simple but powerful framework for action. Swap polluting energy for clean alternatives in your home and daily life. I've talked about that. Share facts, concerns, and solutions with those around you. And speak up and push leaders at every level to act on climate. Those are her ways of helping. And so, in summary, we need new technology, caring theology, enabling economics to save our ecology. So here are a few references. And just maybe switch back to my final slide. So thank you.
Okay. Are there any questions for Paul?
Yes.
Yeah.
I just see the graph and just show like how after 2000 we have like more catastrophes, and maybe we have like loss like billions of dollars because of these catastrophes. Do you believe that it is related with the technology that we have? Because, for example, in 2000, it was like the beginning for the new era for the e-commerce and internet and all these platforms, that they just start like the amount increased, like the amount of consume of energy by each individual, because we start to use like computers or cell phones or even like television that we have never seen before. You think that these climate change, like these problems that we have with super cats, it is also related with technology?
Yeah, I think you bring up the issue that, this generative AI, which has human capacity, requires an awful lot of electricity. And it's the question is, when there's more, number one, the good news is that companies like Microsoft are going to non-carbon emitted sources like nuclear. And as a matter of fact, Microsoft is you heard about the Three Mile Island. There was a reactor, a working reactor at Three Mile Island was shut down, and they are funding the revamping of that nuclear reactor so they can have electricity 24/7, and that's a non-carbon emitting. So, and there's another reactor in Michigan that is being refurbished, and then they are looking toward geothermal as a way of generating and helping. So I think the right kind of increased electricity won't be increasing our carbon dioxide emissions. Yes.
So I have been a pretty big advocate for electric vehicles, and I've had a couple of discussions with people who are very against electric vehicles, mainly arguing that the creation of the electric vehicles costs, more carbon emissions than a gas vehicle would. Same as just instead of using gas, they're using coal to power the electricity that's going into the cars. What would you say to someone arguing against that?
Well, it turns out I do have a chart, which I don't have handy, but it turns out some scientists have, of course, the carbon dioxide emissions from driving your electricity, it's not at the tailpipe, it's at the where the electricity is generated. And it depends on the state. It turns out that the state of New York has the lowest carbon dioxide emissions for electric vehicles. And they translate into that if your conventional gas vehicle had a gas mileage of 121 miles per gallon, your emissions in New York State would be equivalent to your electric car would have that emission. So we know that's well less than so. But then the worst states would be our coal burning states, and it turns out even in coal burning states, the equivalent sort of a emissions, a ordinary car getting 38 miles per gallon would be the equivalent of driving an EV in a coal burning state in our Midwest where we have. And so, but the average ICE internal combustion gets 25 miles per gallon. So even in coal burning states, it's better for our environment. And as far as the manufacturing cost, there's also a chart which gives the greenhouse emissions involved comparing the building of an electric vehicle, and of course the batteries there is an environment of manufacturing vehicles, but the chart turns out that the emissions from an ordinary vehicle, gas burning vehicles, are much greater than the equivalent emissions in manufacturing electric car. Of course, the electric car emissions are zero, and they're only at the generating plant.
Yeah. On the chart that showed the increasing costs of storms in the billions, were those numbers leveled for inflation and the cost of the change in the amount of the dollar, or was that just raw numbers from there?
Yeah, I'm not sure. It was just basically there's a $1 billion threshold. I don't know how that was normalized, but I think that would be a very small correction. Let me, if I can go back to that chart. That's a very busy chart. Maybe I can quickly go back to that chart. Yeah, it's a very busy chart, as you can see. But you can see that whether it's correct or not, that there's been a very dramatic.
Pardon? Yep, there it is. Okay.
PPI
thank you.
Oh, it does see that. Okay. All right. So, that it says right on there. But it is interesting. By the way, my first involvement, that got my attention. I had relatives in New Orleans who were among the 200,000 people who were homeless because of Hurricane Katrina. And here it is right here. That was our most costly hurricane, right? Right. This peak here, that was the peak cost during those years. I mentioned the flash floods, the flooding. You see, then also you can see hurricanes, which are tropical cyclones, are substantial. I have family in Florida, and I've been very close attention. But what struck me is the increase is largely the green bar seems to be the ones that are increasing the most, and these are severe storm counts. Any idea what those are? I looked it up. It turns out mostly tornadoes in the Midwest, which is a surprise to me. I looked up the data, and it is not only, as you've seen the data, when a tornado moves through a community, total destruction. But it's not that big an area. But it turns out that these hailstorms are, these tornadoes are accompanied by gulf ball size hailstorms, which are not good for your vehicle or your house. So it's the combined damage of these tornadoes, which take place in the Midwest, are the biggest cost reason for the increase in the number of $1 billion weather disasters. But it's a breakout of all of them. But the alarming thing is that it was moderate for two decades. The number of weather disasters was under seven. Number of $1 billion disasters, but the number of $1 billion disasters has increased dramatically in the last few years. Includes, by the way, this includes forest fires. The forest fires are on here. Where's forest fire? Yeah, forest fires are here. They're sort of this. I guess that's that was right here. So anyway, they say the most dramatic increase impact of climate change has been these costly weather disasters.
Okay. Well, we are out of time for the session, so thank you for attending, and have a good rest of your week.
Thank you.